Welcome to Enlightenment Rocks. We're your hosts, Kate Rudy
and Stephanie O'Rourke.
In this podcast, we explore the past, present, and future of Scotland's landscape, and especially the famous rock formations at Glen Tilt in central Scotland.
Through interviews with artists, historians, and scientists, we chart a path through the unique topography of Scotland from the 18th century to the present day and into our climate's future. Although James Hutton receives a lot of attention in this podcast, he was by no means the only person whose scientific exploration of the Scottish landscape was enormously impactful. In the 19th century, one of the most evocative and lyrical writers on the geological and cultural history of Scotland's topography was a man named Hugh Miller. For this episode, I'm joined by Professor Ralph O'Connor from the University of Aberdeen, who speaks to us about how geological literature, something we might today think of as being very dry and very technical, could weave together fairy stories and stunning lyricism and really bring the geological past of Scotland to life to the reader. Ralph, could you begin by introducing yourself?
I'm Ralph O'Connor. I'm a professor at the University of Aberdeen, where I teach in the history department, Department of Celtic and Anglo-Saxon Studies, and the English department. And I work primarily on medieval literature of a more or less folkloric nature and 19th and early 20th century literature and science. And my biggest interest in that modern area is the writings of Hugh Miller, the Northeast Scottish geologist and writer.
To help us understand the broader context, can you tell us why geology was a popular subject for non-scientists in the 19th century?
Geology became popular because it was made popular by the people who really got it started as a science worthy of investigation in Britain. And this took place from the turn of the century, so during the period of the Revolutionary Wars, when France and Britain were at war. And the Geological Society of London was crucial in this, founded in the first decade of the 19th century. People like Sir Humphry Davy, famous to us as a chemist, but actually a wide-ranging naturalist and philosopher, who gave geological lectures in London in order to attract public support for a science that threatened to seem dangerously revolutionary to the very reactionary politics of the time. The political classes in Britain in the first couple of decades of the 19th century were deeply concerned that there might be a rerun of the French Revolution taking place in Britain. And the kind of science that geologists were doing, including in Scotland, was tainted with the same aura of radical, anti-clerical, because it expanded the range of pastime beyond what was set down in traditional interpretations of the Bible. So it was seen as dangerous knowledge and was suspected as such. The gentlemen who set up the Geological Society of London had to work very hard to try to counter that narrative, that perception. So they did a lot of work, especially the clergymen among them. People like William Buckland did a lot of work at Oxford University to persuade the new generation of trainee clergy, because that's what Oxford University was for, by and large, training clergy in an elite setting. He wanted to persuade them that it was perfectly harmonious with traditional understandings of Christianity and of sacred history. And other geologists also made sure to try to set their science along those lines, even though they were not all equally invested in reconciling geology with scripture. But there was a large-scale project going on among the more liberal-minded clerics of the day, including people like Buckland and the evangelical Adam Sedgwick in Cambridge, to try to raise geology, to get it out of this label of being a dangerous science and into the realm of being a rather exciting, but nevertheless spiritually healthy science, and going along with a general move to try to promote the study of natural history as something that could improve the mind, because this was the era of useful knowledge when philanthropists and reform-minded politicians were trying to persuade the public that they should stop reading fiction and start reading about facts and getting to know about reality, a kind of view that's parodied in works like Charles Dickens's Hard Times. This was the 1810s, 1820s, the era of useful knowledge, when any knowledge that could be useful was also being marketed as potentially interesting. And geology, fortunately, had plenty of interest that could be latched onto in that way and made entertaining as well as useful. Geology also had economic possibilities. If you could tell what strata you were going to encounter when you dug down looking for coal, you'd be able to predict whether coal was likely to lie underneath this rock or not and avoid wasting vast sums of money that many landowners did waste in prospecting for coal. This being the time of the Industrial Revolution when finding coal was very, very important. So there are all these different reasons why geology was in the public eye, had to be rescued from certain stigmas, but also had a sort of backbone of usefulness which could be drawn on and built on to promote to gather public support.
One of the most popular 19th century writers on geology was Hugh Miller. And Miller was an unusual and interesting character that you've done significant research on. Can you begin by telling us about who Hugh Miller was and how he came to be interested in the geology of Scotland?
Well, he's most famous as a stonemason and writer. He started out as a school dropout. He had a difficult time at school because he was bigger than the other boys of his age, very strong and self-willed. He got into fights constantly, and he ended up getting into a really bad fight with the schoolmaster in his early to mid-teens. And that was his last day at school. He left at that point and decided to spend his daytime just exploring the local countryside in Cromarty on the Black Isle, which is where he had been born. And with a gang of friends, he would go and have adventures in the local caves and spend some time with the local traveller community, basically playing truant and getting to know his local landscape. That was what it was all about for him. He had this ambition of becoming a writer. And at school, among his friends, he was known as the Shanachie, the storyteller. He was always coming up with stories, and he would put those gifts into practice when he became a published writer in due course. But he spent a lot of time collecting stories, folk stories, from people around the village of Cromarty, from people on the Black Isle generally. He would go and seek out the older members of the population to find out oral traditions and stories about life in times gone by. And so he started his literary career as a kind of folklore collector. But his job was a stonemason. He decided that being a stonemason would enable him to have more time for writing during the winter season when there wasn't going to be quarrying work and building going on. So it's a bit of an odd rationale for deciding to be a stonemason. But anyway, that was his decision. It was extremely physically punishing work. As with all masons at the time, he breathed in a lot of stone dust and became physically weakened as a result. I mean, the average life expectancy of a stonemason in the early 19th century was much lower than those with clerical jobs. Anyhow, after a few years of this, which gave him wide experience of Scotland's landscapes and the working classes especially, after a few years of this, he ended up having to take time out and changed career to become an accountant, a total change, in the local bank in Cromarty, and started to earn more money, eventually got married on the back of that. But he continued none of this really related to his real passion, which was geology. He had got to know the rocks of his local area through being a stonemason. Some of his mason friends had told him where he could find more fossils, like the ones that he was accidentally coming across in the quarries on the local beaches. And so he was becoming quite well versed in where to find certain kinds of fossils by the time he exited this very working class career and became, as it were, joined the middle classes, the upwardly mobile middle classes. And by this time, he was also practicing his writing a lot more. He became locally a bit of a celebrity for his writing about the local fishing industry, for example, and his political pamphlets, because he was big on reform. and on giving more of a voice to the lower classes. And in the end, on the back of that activity, his political activism, he was approached and headhunted for a very prestigious editorial job as editor of a new newspaper based in Edinburgh called The Witness, which he got in 1840. And that's where his mature career begins, 1840 till his death in 1856. During that time, he was editor of The Witness. He wrote more than 2,000 individual pieces for that. It came out twice a week, including on geology, but obviously on all other subjects as well, current affairs all across the world. And for most of that time, he was also owner of The Witness. But during that time, he continued his work as a geologist, which is where it's as a geologist that he's most famous today. And he wrote a number of geological articles for The Witness, geological books, gave lectures. His most famous geological book is The Old Red Sandstone, published in 1841, that really made his name as a geologist. And from that point on until his death, he never looked back and his reputation just rose and rose. He was working in the era before the widespread acceptance of evolutionary theory. So for us today, his geology and his science generally looks very old-fashioned, but at its time, it was really at the cutting edge. Although he wasn't an elite geologist of the likes of Charles Darwin, Charles Lyell, you know, the big gentleman geologists of the day, he wasn't an authority in that sense, but he was recognised as an authority on the fossils of his own formation, the Old Red Sandstone, which is where Cromarty comes in, and as a man with an exceptional eye for details of fossil anatomy. So he was a respected geologist, despite really being self-taught in that way.
Miller's most famous and popular text is called The Old Red Sandstone, as you were just saying. What actually is Old Red Sandstone? And what did Miller learn from looking at it?
So sandstone is obviously sand that's become compacted and become stone, but the Old Red Sandstone is the name of a specific geological formation which we would now call Devonian. This is just before the Carboniferous period when coal is laid down. And during the Devonian period, a lot of sand gets washed down from rivers into what's probably a shallow lake. Miller and his contemporaries assumed it was the sea, probably a vast lake, burying billions of fish, which didn't have jaws of the same kind as our modern fish today, placoderms or placoids. And Miller discovered a number of these fish, which were new to science in his day. And part of the point of his book, The Old Red Sandstone, was to show the world this strange new fauna of primitive, as they were seen as primitive fish from a very early period in the history of life.
What is Miller trying to do in his work? What kind of vision about the history of the Scottish landscape does he put forward?
Okay, well, his book, The Old Red Sandstone, has a subtitle that gives a big clue to its purpose. The subtitle is New Walks in an Old Field. So the old field is Cromarty. It's his own local area. And a large part of the book is structured around reminiscences or reminders of what the local landscape has to offer. And what happens if you start to look at the landscape with another kind of eye, the kind of eye that doesn't just look at the beauty of the landscape, although that comes across over and over again in the book, but looks through the different forms that are visible in the landscape to understand its history and how it came to be the way it is. It really gives you a sense that what he's trying to do is he's starting out as somebody who's trying to get to know his landscape intimately. And he does that by getting to know the people who've inhabited that landscape, whose families have lived there for generations, and hearing their stories about it. So that way he populates his local landscape with associations, with stories, with a history, an oral history. And then what he's doing as a geologist is he's looking, I mean, there's actually a passage from his Scenes and Legends, just a couple of sentences, which I'll read out, because this illustrates what he's trying to do when he looks at the landscape as a scientific investigator. He first evokes the beautiful scenery from a viewpoint above his native town of Cromarty, and then he says, let us survey the landscape a second time, not merely in its pictorial aspect, but as antiquaries of the world, as students of those wonderful monuments of nature on which she has traced her hieroglyphical inscriptions of plants and animals that impart to us the history not of a former age, but of a former creation. And then he goes on to talk about how geology is the most poetical of the sciences because it opens up this vista of past history. Miller was a creationist, but he believed that the history of creation was millions, perhaps billions of years old. At one level, it's a history of the Devonian period as visible through the fossil record in Cromarty and around Cromarty. At another level, it's a series of virtual walks or rambles where Miller actually guides his reader around as if you're walking with him. It's very vivid. It's sort of David Attenborough style rambles around his local landscape. At a third level, towards the end of the book, it really takes off into something extraordinary where Miller becomes a guide, a sort of time traveling guide, taking his readers into the past. So having traveled with them around the local landscape and shown them how to read it, he then dives back in time with them and shows them what it would be like if we were actually back then in the Devonian period, all those hundreds of millions of years ago.
How does Miller combine geology with poetry? Many of us might today assume that geology and poetry, mythology, have nothing to do with one another. How do they fit together here?
Yeah, that's a very good question. There's one very bizarre moment to a modern reader, very bizarre moment in the Old Red Sandstone, where Miller is describing the scenery around Ethe, which is a wonderful beach with actually what we would call Jurassic fossils on it. Anyhow, Miller just had been describing the scenery of Ethe and helping his readers to understand the history of that scenery, how it came into being. But then, having described all that, he adds a footnote, which lasts for about three pages. It's one of these long Victorian footnotes, which basically tells three fairy stories, local fairy stories associated with the same locality, the Burn of Ethe, an overgrown valley with a little waterfall. And he says something along the lines of, it seems to be natural that a picturesque setting would attract picturesque stories, and then goes on to repeat the stories. It seems completely extraneous at one level, as if it's just been included for entertainment. But one of the stories that he includes gives an account of a local farm boy, perhaps 60 years before, witnessing the final departure of the fairies from that part of Scotland. He sees this long march, you know, such as the kind of thing we see in countless other Gaelic and Scots folk tales about the disappearing fairies and in The Lord of the Rings and everything else. The fairies are processing out. They're looking rather misshapen and rather frightening. The boy is afraid, but he gradually plucks up the courage so that when the last of them is trotting on its pony out of the valley, he says, "Who are you?" And the man turns round in his saddle and says, "Not of the race of Adam, and this is the last you'll see of our kind in Scotland," or words to that effect. And you start to realise, as you're reading this, that what Miller is doing in the whole book, The Old Red Sandstone, he's trying to bring to life these very strange otherworldly beings from a former era, which are as unreal to his own readers and fantastical as fairies. And he keeps on emphasizing the point that geology is like today's version of enjoying fairy stories, that it presents all the thrills of supernatural fiction or those kinds of wild stories and romances, while also being true history. Miller was a huge admirer of Walter Scott. And Miller presents fairy stories as evidence of less civilized states of mind. He's very much taking this sort of Enlightenment view of fairy stories as relics, or almost, he calls them mental fossils. In fact, he draws the analogy, fossils of an earlier state of mind that people who are less educated would believe. And he himself knew that his mother shared many of those beliefs herself. It's a slightly condescending attitude at one level, but he's trying to show that it's part of the development of society to share these kinds of stories about local landscapes and about the unexplained as part of a way of trying to think through real world problems and issues, and that the scientific perspective that he can now benefit from is a natural development from what he sees as this more folkloric way of thinking.
Across the podcast, we've been trying to understand how historical figures and geological events are present to us today. So, for example, did Miller have a sense of conservation or the now widespread idea that we need to protect the Scottish environment from harmful changes?
Miller was very well aware of how fragile the visible relics of at least human antiquity were. We don't find anything in his writings, at least I can't think off the top of my head, of anywhere in his writings where he advocates the preservation of a geological site as such. But that may just simply be because he couldn't envisage the kind of degradation that some of these sites would undergo through intensive collecting, for instance. He shows no qualms about going down to Ethy on the Black Isle and you know, hacking at the rock there. And nowadays, of course, we're not allowed to do that, because if we did, it would be depleted. But Miller shows very much a conservationist's mentality when he writes about ruins of ancient buildings that he's come across in Scotland. There's one account in his autobiography called My Schools and Schoolmasters, where he reminisces about going as a young man, a young stonemason, going past, I think it's on the shores of Loch Shin, up in Sutherland, going past the ruins of a Pictish site of some kind, and being impressed by these ruins and what they signified, and thinking about them and what this building might have been for. I forget the details. And then moving on. Many years later, he then records returning to the site and found that the local landowner had demolished it because it was seen as a relic of pagan superstition by the landowner, and therefore not worth preserving because it was just a relic of the bad old days. And this mentality did, in the 18th and 19th centuries, result in the destruction of some of the more fragile historical monuments in Scotland, probably including masses of stone circles where the stones are not too. One of the main reasons why the recumbent stone circles in my part of Aberdeenshire are still here in such numbers is because the big recumbent stone at their head, for which they're named, is just too big to move. It's massive. So it was part of a process of improvement generally, trying to reduce the land to practical use. So farmers had practical reasons to want to get old buildings off their land. But also this Enlightenment ideology of having outgrown the pagan past, let's get rid of it and efface it so that we can improve the land and make it more useful. Miller, although he was an evangelical, cared very much about maintaining these relics of the past because they were a part of the past. And he had a strong sense in the need to keep that past visible. So he's very scathing about the improving efforts of that landowner who destroyed this Pictish site. There's nothing more that he can do apart from just record his scorn for the kind of attitude that would just wipe that past from the face of the earth. So that's where we see Miller's conservationist mentality. And it only comes up in a few isolated places like that.
Shifting then to natural processes, did Miller and his contemporaries believe that the landscape around them was continuing to change? Were they concerned about that?
Yes, there is a sense of that, especially when Miller's thinking about erosion. He's writing not just as an observer of his local landscape, but he's writing as one of many, many early Victorians who loved and admired the work of Charles Lyell, Lyell's Principles of Geology, published in 1830-33, which was one of the most influential books on geology written in the first half of the century. And a large part of Lyell's aim was to persuade his readers of the reality of physical change going on, even in historical times, and to give example after example of erosion, deposition, landscape change, the effects of volcanic eruptions, the fact that even observable and relatively localized physical change in the present can be seen, if you accumulate enough episodes of that over a number of years, can be seen to produce really quite dramatic physical changes in a landscape. So that perspective Miller applies to his own native Black Isle, and he reflects in one of his early writings on how he'd spoken to an old fisherman who said that he, the fisherman, was now fishing in an area where he used to drag the plough over a field, that the change in sea level or the change in land level was such that even in the space of a few decades, the relative position of land and sea had changed. This is exactly the kind of thing that Lyell's Principles of Geology is full of. And so Miller is just backing that up with his own examples. There is a difference, though, between when Miller's thinking about the future. He makes clear that he knows that we're living in a fast-changing physical environment, and he records a number of examples of local sandstorms that transformed a once fertile property into desert, for example, at Colbin or Forvey, which are still covered in sand dunes where there's a village buried underneath or a great property buried underneath. But when he's talking about the future, I have to look elsewhere to find the kinds of explicit discussions of the geological relics of the human epoch, that kind of perspective that you find in some geological writing of this period. Gideon Mantell is a good example, famous as the man who discovered the Iguanodon, or at least who identified the first known dinosaur, a slightly older contemporary of Miller's. Mantell speculates about how one day geologists will dig up coins and pieces of iron from railways, and these will be the fossils of the human era. So Mantell seems to envisage this ongoing series of changes and developments, even in the nature of human beings themselves. And although he doesn't speculate explicitly on post-human inhabitants of the earth, that seems to be the kind of line in which his thinking goes, which is very much in line with popular evolutionary writers of the day, such as Robert Chambers, author of The Vestiges of Natural History of Creation, which was the big evolutionary work of its time in the decades before Darwin. But because Miller was an evangelical, his understanding of where the present and the future fitted into each other was very much fitted around the idea of sacred history and about salvation history, that as he saw it, we were in the last age of creation, and that at some future point, he never says it's going to be next week or next year or even in the next few centuries, but relatively soon, everything's going to be brought to an end in a final consummation. So in that sense, his historical geological perspective tilts over into something that we'd think of as much more theological.
How do you think Miller's writing and legacy are still alive for us in the present? What can we as contemporary readers draw from it?
The examples that come immediately to mind are not necessarily questions of great urgency, but they just come across so strongly from Miller's writing, like the fact that one of the driving forces behind Miller's writing is the conviction that anyone, no matter what their status in life, can contribute to knowledge. It sounds like a rather facile idea of the democratic intellect, but it was a real passion for Miller. This was so important to him, partly because he was a school dropout, because he'd had such a checkered career in his early years, and because he'd seen the damage that could be done if people who were made to feel that they had no place in the world of knowledge and learning, if those people ended up getting diverted into either the world of mere entertainment on one hand, or physical force chartism on the other, trying to achieve a greater sense of democracy by violent means. And Miller was equally worried about both tendencies. This was amplified by what he saw going on in other countries around the world, especially where revolutions were going on. So for him, the cultivation of knowledge was absolutely essential, not just for the sake of the knowledge itself, but for the achievement of some kind of equality between different classes. He was constantly concerned to try to remove obstacles to knowledge, like the worries about having to learn Latin or Greek terminology. He sort of tries to sort of pull those out of the way and say, don't worry about that. These are just words. You learn words as a baby, you can learn words as an adult. There's no mystery here. He tries to sort of demystify these quite specialized bodies of knowledge, while at the same time presenting them as worthy of a sense of mystery in sort of romantic sense of that word. So that's one thing Miller as a teacher, as an educationalist, that's one of the messages that comes across loud and clear from his writings today. And the fact that he did that so effectively communicated the joy of collecting and the process of acquiring knowledge in such an attractive way is one reason why his works are still being read today. It's one reason why his works grabbed my attention years ago when I first encountered him. The vividness of his prose just jumps out at you and doesn't let you go.
Ralph, do you have a favorite place to explore in Scotland where you can see and reflect on its geological history?
My favorite walks in Scotland are actually around the Black Isle because of the associations that that area has with Hugh Miller and the kind of life that he gave that area through his various works in collecting together stories of all kinds and the geological history of that landscape. So whenever I'm not thinking of the kinds of long walks into the mountains here, the Black Isle is fertile countryside and the walking possibilities are relatively short unless you just walk along the coast, which is extremely challenging at certain points without just falling into the sea or slipping on seaweed. But the kinds of walks that I most enjoy myself in Scotland are walks up into the mountains, for example up in the Northwest Highlands in Sutherland, where you've got this bedrock of gneiss, this sort of pale greyish, very very ancient stone, and then these huge and weird sandstone and quartzite mountains rising up above them in weird and wonderful ways. When Miller was alive, he also knew that area because he travelled there as a journeyman mason, and he describes beautifully the visual effect of looking at this series of tower-like mountains rising from their bedrock. He understood, of course, that the mountains were formed by sedimentary action much later than the bedrock. But he thought that the mountains were made of old red sandstone, as did he got this from Murchison, from other geologists of his own time, and that mistake was then corrected not long after Miller's death. And so, of course, now we see those mountains as made from a much older sandstone that's dated to the Precambrian period. But nevertheless, the basic perspective is still there when you're walking up a mountain like Cunhiag, which is a bit north of Ullapool. You walk up the gneiss and you get onto the sandstone, and then at the very top you can see the quartzite starting to appear. You can feel it under your feet, and if it's been raining at all, you find that you're slipping around and you have to start being extremely careful. The geology changes the feel of the landscape in such tangible ways, and it's that sense of being able to walk and be aware of what's formed those differences in the landscape and in your own bodily relationship to the landscape. There's something very special about being able to make those links intellectually as you're walking and just enjoying the beauty of the scenery and the drama of being high up above the surrounding landscape. It's not something I can connect with my reading of Hugh Miller in a direct way, but I'm certain that I get so much more now out of those kinds of walks after becoming familiar with Hugh Miller's writings. There's a sort of different level of experience that comes with that perspective, trying to put that perspective of the antiquary of the world, to put that into place alongside the more immediate and direct sort of sensory experiences.
That's a beautiful description. And I especially like your evocation of some of the ways that our present day experience of geological landscape can also have rich aesthetic properties. Paying attention to what it feels like to be in a landscape can play a vital role in how we also understand it intellectually, a sentiment I think Miller would be sympathetic to. So with that, Ralph, I'd like to thank you so much for joining us for this episode.
This podcast was made possible by the Knowledge Exchange and Impact Fund at the University of St. Andrews. The hosts are Kate Rudy and Stephanie O'Rourke. This series was mostly recorded online because of the pandemic, with some live recording by John Michael Kennedy. Sound production is by Eggbox Audio. The editor was Zoe Irvin, and the assistant editor, Molly Fredrickson. Music composed, played, and recorded by Elizabeth Flett, with thanks to Colin McAndrew, Barry Stewart, Al McGowan, and the Royal Society of Edinburgh.